Thank you for the chance to come and talk today. As Jeff was saying, I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm a human nutritionist, although all of my educational background is in agriculture, all my degrees, and I also, for a number of years, ran a family farming operation. So I have a big background in agriculture, but I've spent all my professional life as a human nutritionist. And for a long time, I saw the two as very diverse disciplines that had no connection. And starting really about 15 years ago, I realized that no, the two are really need some connection. So I'm going to do two things. I'm going to start with an argument as to why we need to connect the two. And then the second thing I'm going to go into is, if we're going to connect the two, the big thing we need are data. And you're going to see a lot of similarities to the previous talk, talking about how do we link data, why do we need to link data, and really talking about some of the problems in linking data. I love to use art to illustrate my points, because art is really a reflection of the society at the time. And so if you look at art from the 15th to the 18th, even 19th century, and you look at art that has to do with agriculture, you see there's no separation of food and food and sustenance and agriculture. People grew food to be able to eat. It's reflected in the art. They're all sitting around eating what they grew. Their health is dependent on the field. And you know, Hippocrates, with "let food be thy medicine and medicine thy food," really summed it up. The purpose of food is health. But you know, you go to today, and the art shows a different picture. All of a sudden, food and nutrition become this impersonal, industrialized concept, and it's really affected how we look at agriculture, and it's created what I see as a great food health divide. You have you know, food comes out of cans, it comes out of restaurants, and health comes from a doctor, it comes out of pills. There's no connection there anymore. And you look at the art of agriculture, and increasingly today, agriculture is seen as this great machine that really, to many people, is pouring out poor health and pouring out environmental damage. And you know, you look at these pictures, this is what we see out in the common perception of things. So you know, how do we go about changing this? Why do we need to change it? Well, let's talk a little bit about the way I see the way we look at food and health. You know, let's talk about the food supply in general. And the food supply in general, you know, food supply is one of these amorphous terms that really means what people want it to mean. But in general, the way I use it is, the food supply is everything from farm to fork. It includes the producer, the processor, the transporter, the storage, the wholesale, the retail, and then finally the consumer. So let's take a look at the way this food supply gets divvied up and the way we look at it. So if we look at the food supply from the point of view of producers and manufacturers, food manufacturers, you know, agriculture producers are concerned about things such as genetics. They're concerned about production systems. Increasingly, they're concerned about environment and sustainability. They're concerned about health of plants, of health of animals. They're concerned about technology, post-harvest processing. The food industry is concerned about things such as processing technology and, you know, components, ingredients, etc. On the other hand, the nutrition health industry is concerned about dietary guidance. They're concerned about nutrients, not crops. They're concerned about medical advice, the biochemistry of metabolism in humans. We make federal policy. We work with there are groups like FDA and EPA that work on, the regulatory policy. There's dietetic advice. There's disease prevention. And this has created what I call the canyon. We've lost all connection between agriculture production, the food industry, and human nutrition. If you don't believe me, in the group that I'm in, American Society of Nutrition, I'm part of a group that's really trying to bring this back together. And we had a big symposia experimental biology this year, where we brought in leaders all the way around. And what we find at this stage is that people are still talking at each other. And they're talking at each other with totally different lexicons, dictionaries, words. And there's just what we need to begin to bridge this is we've really got to begin with some conversations. So we need integration, and we need integration where we put the consumer back at the middle. I'd also add, you've also got to have the producer at the middle, too, to be able to maintain the profit. But we need to integrate all this. But I have a caveat there. Is there a meaningful connection? We've really got to find, what are the meaningful connections between production and consumption? So we need to do this, but we're doing it in a very challenging environment. This is a graph of WHO's UN predictions of population increase over next 80 years now. And, it goes from soaring population to population that begins to level off about 2050 to some other models that show a sharp decline after 2050. But all of them are showing that we're going to get up around 9 billion people by the year 2050. So we have this huge population increase, and even more than the population increase, we hear about this all the time. That's not the real challenge. The real challenge are 3 billion that are going to enter the middle class by 2050. And when 3 billion enter the middle class, that means 3 billion people are going to want the food that we eat. And that's going to put even more, an almost unprecedented challenge on the type of food, on how we produce food and how we manufacture food and how we sell food. So this is the background we're in. We're in the background of this enormous challenge of increasing population. We're also this is a very interesting set of data here. We're looking at some very unique health challenges. Take a look at the country of Uzbekistan. The blue bars show the percent of people in Uzbekistan that have malnutrition, undernutrition, wasting. But the percentage of people that have wasting and the percent of people that are obese are almost the same. And this is happening around the world. The twin problems of malnutrition, undernutrition and obesity, exist simultaneously. So this is another problem that has to do with the food system, another big challenge. And then, of course, we have the challenge of big environmental impacts, which is illustrated by this picture of the declining water resources in the Central California Valley. And, we get a lot of talk about climate change and temperature and how it's going to impact. But if we were going to eat according to the dietary guidelines, which means a lot more fruits, vegetables, and nuts, our limitation wouldn't be temperature. Our limitation would be the water to produce it. This is the big thing. How are we going to supply the world with the higher quality foods they want with the very limited environmental constraints, especially water? So we need healthy, sustainable food systems. And it's got to be built around consumer health. A constantly available supply of complete nutrition. And I underline constantly available because we're not Ford Motor Company that's coming out with a new Mustang next year and we're able to shut down the plant for 3 months and retool how we do it. A lot of people die if you shut down agriculture in 3 months. We've got to be able to make these changes while continuing every single day to produce. It's got to be affordable and it's got to be accessible. We have to have a worldview sufficient to feed the world population and allow for choice. I don't know how many talks I've been to where, you know, people get up and they talk about, well, India's emerging as this massive middle class, and we want to make certain that India does not make the same nutritional mistakes as us. Well wait a minute. What right do we have to tell India how to eat? We've got to give them the choice. We'll give them the advice as well, but they have to have the choice. And what's more, they will have the choice. They're going to come in and choose food, and it's going to impact us. Minimize environmental impact, and it's got to be economically sustainable for the producer. And most of all, we need data. We need diverse types of data. We need data that adequately define the uncertainty, and we need data that model the system and look for meaningful effects. And this is a word that I like to use a lot, meaningful effects. Every single thing has an effect. The question is not whether it has an effect. The question is instead whether that effect rises above the background noise to actually have an impact. And there's a great quote that I like to use, and unfortunately I deleted it from here, but it's a great quote from a toxicologist called Aaron Vodalski, and he's written a lot with Bruce Ames, and he writes a lot about he's in California and he writes a lot about the minor things that are looked at in toxicology. And his point is that every single thing has an impact, but the search for possibilities is endless. However, it's not the possibilities that we need to find. We need to find the meaningful effects that have big impact, because that's where we put our dollars and that's where we can really make a difference. So talk a little bit about how we need to look at, if we're going to do this, how we need to look at the food system. I love to use this picture. This is the public's perception of the food supply. Man, it's quick, it's nimble, it responds to everything we say, it turns on a dime, it's easily controlled. All we got to do is we got to say, and it's going to change tomorrow. Those of us in the food system know this is the food system. It's massive. It's also very imprecise, with a heck of a lot of variability. It's very difficult to steer. You make a change in the food system today, like this ship, it's a lot of work to bring it back in the direction if you find you're wrong. Many, many competing interests pushing it in all different directions. So, you know, this is the reality of the food system, and how do we work with that? This is another reality we have to deal with. This is the public perception of health. Look at this athletic, beautiful person, and what are they surrounded with? They're surrounded with pure, natural, wholesome, unprocessed foods. This, however, is a paper that comes out of a survey that Ag Research Service actually participates in, called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, where we look at thousands of people every single year. We do complete medical history on them, and we also do dietary assessment. And so we're able to connect diet to health outcomes. And this paper, they look at 25,000 people in Haines, and they look to see how processing level affected health outcomes. And the conclusion is the processing level was a minor determinant of the individual food nutrient contribution to the diet, and therefore processing level should not be a primary factor when selecting a balanced diet. Completely explodes what's out there in eat this, not that. You can have a good diet off of processed foods. It's not processed foods, it's the diet. So this is another big one we have to look at. Addresses the inherent variability of composition of foods and its impact on health. Cruciferous vegetables. I worked a lot with cruciferous vegetables when I was in the laboratory. Cruciferous vegetables, such as broccoli and cauliflower, etc., have substances in them called glucosinolates. And glucosinolates, a lot of work has been done on glucosinolates because they really seem to reduce the incidence of cancer. They may have some benefit to a number of things. Basically, we found the molecular mechanism is that these components, which get cleaved to an associated isothiocyanate, these isothiocyanate can sit on a gene activator called the antioxidant response element and turn on a whole battery of antioxidant genes at one time. And this battery of antioxidant genes really seems to be able to control a lot of the toxins that are in the body. Well, what we find, so cruciferous vegetables, they're great, they're good for you. Except that out of all the glucosinolates, there's really only one glucosinolate that activates the antioxidant response element, and that's glucoraphanin. Well, if you look at broccoli and cabbage and bok choy and cauliflower, really of all of those foods, only broccoli, while it has only a moderate or even a small amount of glucosinolates, it has mostly glucoraphanin. So the variability is there, and it really comes down to the component that's there. But it's even more than that. If you look at the individual cultivars of broccoli, you can find that there are some broccolis that are extremely high in total glucosinolate, but their glucoraphanin content is very low. One of the asides on this, you may have seen in Costco a type of broccoli called Beneforte broccoli. I don't know if anybody's seen that. Beneforte was developed by the Monsanto group that's out in Davis, California, and they guarantee the level of glucoraphanin in the Beneforte broccoli. So it's actually made this nutritional property is actually made its way into the mainstream by people seeking to get more of the glucosinolate. But there's an excellent paper out there by two Dutch researchers, Dekker and Verkerk. I love to use this paper. It's published in 2003. And so Dekker and Verkerk, they take a look at this assumption that broccoli and cruciferous vegetables protect against cancer. And if you do a meta-analysis of epidemiologic studies, you find that there's a very clear association with inverse association between the consumption of eating crucifers and the reduction of cancer, and that it is very clearly associated with glucosinolate concentration. However, all those glucosinolate concentrations, when they do it, they take a single number and they throw it in there for broccoli or whatever the people were doing. So what Dekker and Verkerk did is they used a Monte Carlo modeling procedure. And instead of using a single number, they put in a range of glucosinolate concentrations. And then they redo it. And when they redid it, there was absolutely no protection by glucosinolates against cancer. So variability is huge, and we just don't assess this in our big picture of the food system. So we know that agricultural production practices affect nutrient accumulation and composition, but can they actually affect human health? So we let's say we work on a product that has increased nutritional composition. We get people to eat it. Man, we're finally going to make a big impact on human health. Well, let me show you a study that we funded out in Davis, California. If you take mushrooms and you sit there, first of all, back up a little bit. Vitamin D, I think everyone knows, is the essential nutrient. There are two types of vitamin D. There's vitamin D2 and there's vitamin D3. Both of those can be used by the human body. If you take mushrooms and you subject them to UV light, mushrooms will accumulate a great deal of vitamin D2, which makes them a great source of vitamin D supplement. So the mushroom industry has been doing this. There are all kinds of mushrooms out on the market. So in our human study, we took these and we fed them to people, and we looked at the vitamin D status. Well, if you look at this, the graph in the top left, this is what happens to vitamin D2 as you eat that, and it goes steadily up. The more you eat, the greater amount of vitamin D2. That's really good. You've really helped out people. However, if you look in B, this is what happens to vitamin D3. The same amount the vitamin D2 went up, vitamin D3 went down. What did it do to vitamin D status? Absolutely nothing. So these are the types of things we really have to look at if we're really going to integrate this. Can we put all this energy in there, make a great change in the food system, and in the end, we still have absolutely no impact on human health? So, now I want to switch and talk about the data and talk a little bit about what we're doing and maybe give some, ideas. And like the previous speaker, I've learned to speak a few data terms, but I'm not a data native at all. And one of the things I've really learned is that, we really need, I think you really made the point, we need to be able to take the people who are digital natives who have the ability to manipulate data, and then we've got to really bring in the constraints of what we know from a science point of view and begin to meld these together, because we're both missing something. So how can we improve health? We've got these big picture questions. These are the type of data that are out there, both in ARS and in all around. We've got in the center here all our nutritional data. We've got we have a nutrient database that some of you may have seen called Standard Reference Database. Then there are all these data that connect to public health. We've got consumer data. We've got databases that are out there, other nutritional databases. And then we have all these ag data, which includes new and animal genetic data. They're all separate. So the first thing we're doing is we're consolidating our nutrient data. We've poured a ton of money into consolidating this. And I should point out that we went from 18 months ago, we had 8,000 entries in our database. Today we have 220,000 entries. And to show the importance of it, in the last year we had 22 million page views for our data, about 1.6 million users. We're the single most biggest user of anything in the National Ag Library by far. So we consolidate our data, and then we want a big picture. And I'll skip through this and show, but really what we want is we want to be able to bring in information on the food cultivar, season, location, estimates of variability, environmental data, data such as fingerprints. And then finally, Once we get all of this data in our human nutrition component, we want to be able to connect these data, and we want to be able to link them. And we're working on that now. One of the things we're working on is linking directly with the NuaNet database, linking through Ag Data Commons to these other databases. And I will end up with, there's one thing here that, and this was alluded to in the end of the last talk, talking about metadata. It's bigger than that. It's ontology, how we talk about the data. We have to have a common point, a common way to talk. And it also has to do with structure of data. One of the things I have really learned in working with some data people, most of our databases are built off of SQL. SQL looks at, SQL works by taking a word and reducing it to a digit, to an abstract, and then you're able to connect these digital numbers. However, the bigger ontology databases, such as Google, they work off of a different system that is able to look at the nuances of words. For example, there's one called Sparkle. And we really need to think about that, that if we're really going to go into the next to the next generation, it's not just one-to-one connections, but it's being able to use the new digital way of thinking that begins to look at it almost like language and begin to consolidate these data. So what does this all do for us? I like to end it with this illustration. Here's the old reductionist approach where you looked at yield and you looked at input and you looked at yield and here's your maximum. But now we throw in a third axis. This is nutritional composition. All of a sudden our true maximum becomes very, very different when we look at it like that. So I'll end with that. Thank you.